Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. What makes a city livable, most livable? Whatever it is, new surveys say American cities don't have it, at least not in comparison to their global competitors. Vancouver, Vienna, Melbourne, Zurich, Copenhagen, Tokyo. Yes, top scorers. New York, Chicago, LA, Seattle. Nowhere in the top flight, not the top 10 or 20 or 30. So are the surveys flawed or do we have a problem here, Houston? This hour, On Point, most livable cities. And where's the USA? You can join the conversation. What makes a most livable city? And is it really so much more abundant abroad? We also welcome your comments at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will hear in this hour from global travel writer Pico Iyer and global urban thinker and defender of the American city, Joel Kotkin. Joining me first from London is Tyler Brulé, columnist for the Financial Times, editor-in-chief of Monocle magazine, a publication Wikipedia calls a cross between foreign policy and Vanity Fair. He's also founder of the international style magazine Wallpaper. He headed Monocle's 2009 Quality of Life Survey, ranking the globe's most livable cities. We saw it in the Financial Times last week. Tyler, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So I'm looking, and top 10, we get Zippo on your list from the United States. You've got Zurich, Copenhagen, Tokyo, Munich, Helsinki, Stockholm, Vienna, Paris, Melbourne, lots of Australia, Berlin. By 11, we get to Honolulu, and that's the only one in the top 25. We've got other surveys with very similar results. The Economist Intelligence Unit, you've got to go to number 29 to find an American city. What's wrong with American cities?
At least we were more generous as a start anyway.
Yeah.
I think that there are a number of challenges, and I don't know if we want to go into the metrics right away, but we look at some very basic things like many of these international surveys do, Tom. So we look at crime. We look at the state of public education. We look at public transport. We look at the quality of housing. For our audience, we also look at global connectivity, and I'm not just talking about electronic connectivity. I'm also talking about the number of long-haul destinations you can reach from you know, whatever city you happen to be based or whatever city we're measuring. So that was part of the starting point. But then we also look at issues of local economy, so the importance of small or family-run enterprises. We look at softer things like the number of cinema screens a city has. But also, it gets even softer or harder, as the case may be. Is there easy access to a drink in the wee hours? And we also look at hours of sunshine. So if we start with crime, despite the fact that a lot of U.S. mayors have been doing quite an admirable job of cleaning up the streets, one of the big challenges is that there is still a very high homicide rate for most U.S. cities. And that's a basic measure that knocks a lot of cities out of the running immediately.
Big a factor is that? Is it dragged down all the other good things about American cities because our homicide is high compared to, what, your Zurich, Copenhagen, Tokyo, Munich?
Absolutely. I mean, and I would say that that quite off the charts when you compare when you look at the murder rates of some of these cities. It's not the only point, but
okay,
I think most of us think about public safety when we get out of bed in the morning or when we turn off the lights in the evening. So that, you know, that is when we start with probably, and we probably start with about 50 cities, and then we work our way to 40 to 30, and then of course as mentioned, we present our global 20. So that knocks quite a few off. If we look at global connections, of course, yes, the likes of Los Angeles and New York and, you know, many U.S. centers very well connected to the world. But then if we get off the aircraft and then we try to get into the city, it's remarkable how few U.S. cities have high speed rail link into the urban core. Very, very few, in fact, and it also counts against many cities in my native Canada as well. So we try to also go through either not just the visitors' experience and how they would use the city, but also we look at it through the eyes of also being a resident at the same time.
You guys have your list out. There are a number of lists out. The Economist I mentioned they.
what rank 140 cities from sort of best to worst. And they start up with Vancouver, Vienna, and Austria, Melbourne, Australia. Mm-hmm. Australia and New Zealand do well in both these surveys.
Very well, yes.
They go all the way down to the bottom where you've got Algiers and Harare, Zimbabwe at the very bottom. Algiers, Dhaka, Bangladesh, thanks to civil instability and poor infrastructure. Mm. There's a lot in the middle. They look at stability, healthcare, culture, environment, education, infrastructure. But I can't help wondering, I mean, you make it hard for me to ask this when you start out right off with murder as American city's number one problem. But I mean, but is there something sort of, I don't know, hoity-toity, jet-setty about these that puts American cities off the map, or are cities just down at the heel?
Not at all, at least going to the hoity-toity bit of your question. I think that, and, you know, it's not because, you know, both of our titles are I think, probably about a kilometer and a half apart in London. I don't think it's just because we sit on this side of the... Yeah, I don't think it's just because we sit on this side of the Atlantic. Certainly, and I don't really want to speak for The Economist, but they have obviously a very large base, probably perhaps their biggest base in the United States. And we're... You know, perhaps in a similar situation as well, as the U.S. is a very important market to us. But I think when you look at the forces, and I think what we have to remember, this is not, and I think the way you set it up is very accurate in the sense that, let's remember, that we're not talking about the most fun cities in the world. We're not talking about necessarily the best business hubs, and we're maybe not even talking about cultural hubs. But it's, from our point of view, it is the basic measure, and we think of... It was really, we started to distill it last year, Tom, when we thought about, you know, what really makes your day? And mm-hmm. and we looked at this notion of friction. So we think that the minimum amount of friction underfoot, so anything that is an impediment or a hindrance to your day, so too many traffic lights or gridlock or subways that don't work, or the fact that there are no subways or trams potentially, or no bike paths, you know, all of these things score against cities. So mm-hmm. if you look at Zurich, you know, it has an impeccable public transport system. And, you know, when you get beyond the public transport system, it has an amazing airport. Now, why do we look at this notion of having as few impediments to your day? Well, you know, the key thing to us is we think a great day is defined by the maximum number of experiences that you can have. That doesn't mean you have to ram your day, you know, full of meetings mm-hmm. and appointments mm-hmm. and trying to see as many family members. We're just saying that you should have the ability to do as much as possible.
The least
and
resistance to enjoying life in many dimensions.
Absolutely.
Huh. But, you know, on the other hand, I mean, it's been, I don't know, a decade or so since I was in Zurich. But first of all, I could barely afford to breathe there. And it wasn't exactly a hell fellow, well-met kind of city where, I mean, I'm not sure I had the most fun in the world there. You know, Brasserie Lip is beautiful. The view of the lake, wonderful. But I'm not sure I'm packing my bags to live in Zurich. Maybe that's just me. Do you know what I'm talking about?
But a lot of people are. And you think of the
really?
Likes of companies.
Is Zurich
which...
growing?
Zurich is growing, and they're looking to grow it even further. And I think it's – I mean, the likes of also – when you think of fun companies, it's not a company necessarily that I want to work for. But, you know, Google's decided to put their European HQ and also – and a lot of other companies because of that livability issue. But I come back mm-hmm. to your point about fun. Doesn't necessarily mean that you're moving into a barrel of monkeys either. Mm-hmm. And we – you know, and we do point that out. You know, for every city that that we address – we have fixes, and certainly, you know, for Zurich, you know, we talk about, you know, one of the key elements is they have to loosen up their Sunday trading hours. It's very, very difficult to buy things short of going to a train station in Zurich on a Sunday. That's a challenge for the city. And we say that they do need to loosen up a little bit, but there are so many other things working in its favor that it still managed to take our number one place.
On your list, down it goes just through 25. You get down all at
sure.
the bottom down to Lisbon, Geneva, Hamburg, but the Kyoto. But those are still pretty lucky. They made the list. I mean, only one American city made your list, and it's Honolulu. Now, I was trying to think. I mean, Honolulu's lovely. Who wouldn't like, you know, the beach and the sunshine? But what is it about this American city and none other that put it on your list?
A variety of things. Of course, it does well in our sunshine stakes. And if I look at some of the softer elements, it works there. But then what we looked at, and one of the things I failed to mention in the beginning was we added a new metric this year, which mm-hmm. was also about looking over the horizon. So how fiscally responsible has a city been? What what's on the cards for the next 36 months as well? So this also helped Zurich in many ways. And in fact, it was a very, very tight race between Zurich and Copenhagen. And so Zurich really managed to pip them at the post because of some very big developments that are planned. If I look at Honolulu, it's the same thing. I believe that that Capitol Hill, endorse wholeheartedly and think that Honolulu has the best urban or light rail transport concept on the boards, and it seems that it will get the funding that it requires. I'm sure this has nothing to do with Mr. Obama's former residency on the islands. Mm. Yeah. So there's that. We also looked at a climate for small business. So I think we look at the regeneration in downtown Honolulu, what's being done there. Mayor Hanneman is not quite there yet, but you feel that this is a city which could tip back firmly into actually having a vital downtown core. Mm-hmm. And I come back to that notion of community. One of the key things that when we launched this 2 summers ago was we looked at this notion of small businesses, and that was a very important measure to us because as we see it, if you have a small business, whether it's a mom and shop bakery or it's a newsagent or it's a coffee shop, chances are there is recognition when you walk through the front door. They know what type of bread you want or they know the papers that you take in the morning.
And it gives the city pride of place, I guess. There's something in the title.
And recognition. And I think recognition, I was going to say, is the most important thing. And then if you talk to the WHO, the World Health Organization, will say that, in fact, communities where you have strong recognition means that you have happy communities.
Personal, individual recognition. Tyler, hold the thought. We've got to take a break right here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a couple of new lists of the world's most livable cities this hour and why so few American cities are on them. We've been talking with Tyler Brulé. He's editor-in-chief of Monocle magazine. They just made up their annual list of the top 25. One American city made it, Honolulu, at position number 11. Apart from that, Zippo. The Economist is just out with its new list. We can't accuse Tyler of being a London chauvinist. London doesn't make the list. But look at this Economist list, and you've got to look a long way. The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette is celebrating because it's ranked top in U.S. by The Economist, but it's down at 29. It's the first American city even on the list out of that publication in London. Trying to figure out what's going on here. Tyler joins us from London. We're joined as well now from Santa Barbara, California, by journalist, travel writer, wonderful writer, Pico Iyer. He wrote Global Soul, Jet Lag, Shopping Malls, and the Search for Home, and a whole lot more. His newest book out recently in paperback is The Open Road. Pico Iyer, thanks very much for being here.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here, Tom.
So you're all over the world all the time. Maybe these lists are no shock to you at all, or what do you make of them? The fact that so few American cities make the grade by this most livable filter, at least as a couple of London publications put it here. Does it make sense to you? Is there a problem with American cities?
I think there really is. I agree very much with Tyler and with the results of the surveys. As you and Tyler were saying, it must be said that the criteria are a little eccentric for these surveys, and they're not looking for pluses for things that are going right so much as for negatives and things that are going wrong. In other words, they're looking for the absence of friction rather than the presence of excitement. So I think these surveys are a little like a sort of Miss Congeniality competition. They're not looking for the most beautiful or the most talented or the most exciting. They're looking for the place that is fresh, companionable, and frisky, as it were. But if you were to ask me after 30 years of travel which are the most alluring places, I would mention just those, especially I think countries like Tyler's own country, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, which have all the openness and the possibility and the comfort of the U.S., but with few of the shadow sides and few of the complications, and not, they're freed of the burden of importance. I think one of the things that makes the U.S. a difficult place to be is that it's sort of the center of the world. And, Tyler recently wrote a wonderful piece in the FT, Financial Times, in which he said that the most livable city in the world is not necessarily the most interesting, and he tried to live in Zurich and decided to move away. And just as you were saying earlier, if you asked most people on the planet, where would you most like to live? I don't think they would say Zurich, and I do think they would say New York or Los Angeles or San Francisco. But nonetheless, whenever I travel, as soon as I come back to the U.S., I feel like I'm landing in yesterday's country. The U.S. seems to be very more and more out of date, and compared with most of the places in Europe and many of the places in Asia, I think it's old-fashioned.
Pico, give us some tangible, some viscerals on that front. I mean, what do you see or touch, feel, hear when you hit an American city from abroad that makes you feel that way?
The minute you arrive, let's start with the airports. And airports are sort of like a city's calling card. They're the way that the cities present themselves to new arrivals.
Yeah.
And I think survey after survey would mention JFK and LAX, the two most prominent airports in this country, as the most chaotic, disheveled, undeveloped airports in the world, almost. And if you set foot tomorrow in Amsterdam or Singapore or Hong Kong, you really feel as if you're setting foot in the future. Everything is sleek. Things are beautifully organized. They're in four different languages. You see things that are familiar, but you also see things that are particular to the culture. If you arrived this afternoon at JFK or LAX, I think you just feel lost in a chaotic swarm.
Now, that's about sleekness, and that's part of it, and it's the calling card, but of course, that's just for the people who are buzzing all around the planet, which is more and more people, I know, but still, is that the jet-set view of urban life, of livability, Pico?
I don't think so, because if you just go across the border to Toronto, Vancouver, or Montreal, you'll find countries or cities that are very equivalent to our own, but they're just more global, more welcoming, and of course much emptier too. I think most of the cities that feature high on this survey don't have the population pressures that the U.S. cities do. But no, I don't think it's a jet set idea. I think, you know, most of the people arriving in L.A. this afternoon are probably relatively impoverished people from El Salvador or Rwanda or Vietnam coming to make their futures. And when they arrive in the land of plenty, as they see the U.S. to be, I think the first thing that startles them is it's not very friendly. There are very few signs welcoming them. Everyone's speaking a different language. And as Tyler was saying, it's very hard to get just from the airport to their neighborhood. And when they get to the neighborhood, I don't think a wonderful surprise awaits them. And it's interesting that Honolulu is the one U.S. city that does feature in the best lists, because I think of Honolulu as really a Japanese suburb.
Japanese-owned homes there, yeah, and trying to afford that. Let's hear from a couple of American neighborhoods. Pico Iyer, Tyler Brule, please stand by. Spokane, Washington. Trish, you're on the air, Trish.
Hey, great topic. Thanks so much.
Sure.
My question was, I just got back from San Francisco, and I utilized BART. I could not agree more with some of these comments about public transportation. I think we're really lacking that. My question is twofold: vacation time and healthcare benefits. I spoke with some folks from London and Switzerland they were on vacation for 5 weeks. I was on vacation for a few days. Also, healthcare benefits. They are really content with socialized medicine. Curious to know what your comments are and if those two factors played into your metrics.
Trish,
thanks. I'll take my questions off the air.
You got it. Thank you, Trish. Tyler Brule, what about those factors in your assessment of cities' livability?
No, it's a great question by Trish. We clearly looked at public health care, and that was, you know, if I've had to go to a hospital in Zurich once or twice, so I also have firsthand experience. And it is, you know, what Pico is referencing when you sort of talk about stepping into the future, just the way the casualty ward is organized in a city like Zurich. It is like going into the future, as opposed to, and I could even speak to, you know, Canadian hospitals and many others. But even in North America, you sometimes feel like you're stepping back in time a little bit. So it was clearly something that helped vault Zurich to the top. You know, ditto goes with hospitals in Copenhagen as well. Vacation time, that's because it sort of tends to be governed at a federal level, was not something that we looked at. But certainly if we look at our top two cities, the Swiss are pretty good at holidays. The Danes even better. But then,
yeah.
You know, if you look at Japan, the Japanese are not brilliant at taking much time off.
Though if I look on down the list, there is a lot of that kind of Euro economic profile here. Munich and Helsinki and Stockholm, Vienna,
absolutely.
Paris, and Berlin. Let's go to Joy in Boston. Joy, you're on the air.
Hi, my name is Joy. I'm from Honolulu. I live in Boston now. And I wanted to agree about the comment about small business owners knowing who you are when you walk into the shops. I was just home for 3 weeks, and I was just so surprised by how many businesses are still owned by the same people, and they know who you are, and, you know, 3 years later, they remember your name. So that was great. And also, I'm from a Japanese family, and I do believe that there's so much Japanese culture in Honolulu, but also, you know, in Southern California and now in Northern California.
So you can find it all over, but that sense of intimacy of people know my name. Pico Iyer, you make a home abroad very often. You had that piece, The Joy of Less, in the New York Times recently, I think was the most emailed list the day it ran in for a few days about life in Japan. Is there some kind of mark on American cities that the intimacy, the recognition, personal recognition is less, as Tyler says? Joy finds it in Honolulu, so does Tyler, but why would that be in other American cities? Or is it?
I think it's the absence of neighborhood, which you could link to the absence of tradition. Of course, the joy of the U.S. is it's the country that's freest from history, but I think there's also a price that you pay for being free from history. And you're absolutely right. When I go back and forth between California and Japan, and as soon as I'm back in Japan, intimacy is just the word I was going to use. The scale of the neighborhoods is human-sized. People are traveling by public transport or buses or bicycles and not by cars, which makes a big difference. And the language of life in Japan is still very much community, even though it's a 21st or 22nd century kind of culture. And when I come back here to Santa Barbara, which is still a relatively small town, I feel almost as if I'm in a shopping mall. It's like moving from a village green into an airport writ large in some ways. Mm-hmm. And I must say, you know, my family brought me here from England to California in the 1960s. And at that time, I think America really felt like the future. And we were so excited. And to this day, I'm so grateful to my parents for bringing me to here from the old world and from Europe. Mm. But I think while we were enjoying our lives in America, we didn't notice that the rest of the world, or many parts of it, had really surged ahead of us and that we were falling behind.
Pico,
in terms of an international consciousness, I would say, too.
Mm. Pico, and Tyler Berlay, please stand by. I want to welcome another perspective into this conversation. Joining us from Los Angeles, big city, Joel Kotkin. He's the Presidential Fellow on Urban Futures at Chapman University in Orange, California, Senior Fellow with the New America Foundation, Executive Editor of NewGeography.com, which puts out some best cities list of its own. He's author of The City, A Global History. Joel, thanks very much for being here.
Hi. Well, I feel like I'm the visitor from Mars here.
okay. Speak up, visitor from Mars. Give us your take.
Well, I don't know if you have a Martian translator.
yeah, we do.
But I mean, some of this, I think, is accurate in the sense of certainly if you're going to make a huge deal, and I think, you know, and for good reasons, of homicides, that's certainly been the great difference between many American cities and their counterpoints abroad. I travel a pretty good amount, not as much as probably these gentlemen do, but I do travel a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Many of these cities are, in some senses, almost like resort towns. I mean, you know, Honolulu obviously being a key one. Otherwise, one characteristic which I thought was interesting is many of these are cities that have large populations of people who actually don't live there. In other words, second home. So, in other words, one of the things that you find in these cities is you say, well, how can anyone afford to live there? I think that was a comment that was made immediately. Mm-hmm. Well, the fact of the matter is people can't afford to live there. Some of the biggest gaps between the income of median income and housing prices are in exactly these cities. Vancouver is the worst in North America. How does Vancouver do okay? Well, it does okay because a lot of people from particularly overseas Chinese buy apartments there, or people from Canada go there because they relatively speaking, it's the banana belt. And that's a favored retirement place for people from Eastern Canada. I happen to know a little bit about Canada because my wife's from Montreal.
So you're saying these cities that make the list are like formal gardens or something, cities?
Some of them. Some of them are. Some of them are. That's a very interesting list. I mean, Tokyo is completely a different case. And
super
Tokyo
robust, all kinds of people, huge, sprawling, plus very dense.
But one of the interesting things I find about a lot of these places are places with very low birth rates. people aren't going there. You know, we might talk about the United States and certainly has its share of problems, but, you know, half the immigrants in the world go to the United States. Maybe these people are completely deluded to come to this horrific place, but I think people find life differently than the United States. For instance, I think most people actually would prefer to, maybe if they don't have to go too long, drive than take public transit. I think that that's pretty true in a lot of places. I also think that most Americans don't live in the core cities, and the core cities are relatively unimportant. Most American cities, less than 5%, 6%, 7% work in the central core. This is very different than most of these other cities. In most of America, people live in suburbs or exurbs. And interestingly enough—
But does that make for livability? I mean, people in Atlanta sit in those big traffic jams and complain endlessly about it. Houston—
Of course. But you know, they're either they cannot afford to live in the few really nice urban settings, let's say like Gold Coast of Chicago Manhattan. Mm-hmm. If the choice is to live very densely in some inner city neighborhood, they're probably not going to do it. What's interesting is there have been a lot of studies done recently, and where we ask people in terms of their sense of community. And, of course, the urban legend is, well, dense urban communities have more sort of amiability and people know each other and they're more involved. It turned out to be the exact opposite. Almost the further away you got, the more people liked where they lived. But these are the non-existent people. These are the people you're never going to run into. Now, that's true, by the way, in the United States. It's also true to some extent in Canada. It's also true even in the U.K.
Let me turn to Tyler. Tyler, just to get a first response to Joel's alternative, he says, well, your cities are nice, but they're kind of, I don't know, precious or, you know, formal gardens. There aren't enough people there. What do you say, Tyler?
Well, I think maybe we're just isolating Honolulu, and I'm sure that there'd be probably many callers who would also disagree that it's not just a resort town. But you know, the likes of Zurich, Copenhagen, and certainly Joel referenced Tokyo not being the case. But Munich, Helsinki, all of these cities, these are cities where I'm sure 70, 80, 90% of the population is made up of locals. Maybe they have a more international profile. Even that's debatable. But I think what we need to do is separate the discussion almost from we're sort of talking along national lines and talking about this great thing of whether it's America. But I think we need to, I think, isolate. Our discussion is about, I think I see it as cities. So it's really the national versus the urban. And even when we talk about things like birth rates, I mean, Stockholm was recognized as really the urban bump. It is, it is the one European city, actually an international city, which has an extraordinary birth rate at the moment, for example. So I think that we have to be looking at these really on a city-by-city basis.
Pico, and when you hear Joel's sort of alternate view there, what do you say to it? He's saying, hey, density's not so great. People like maybe to live in suburbs. Describe some of these sweet spot cities on the listings anyway as sort of elite precincts.
I thought what Joel was saying was terrific and is very, very convincing and points that needed to be brought into the discussion. I think what that leads me to is that there are, as Tyler was suggesting, cities within the U.S. that would, apart from Honolulu and Pittsburgh, score well on surveys like this, places like Portland, probably, Seattle, Minneapolis. But those are very different from the major driving powers in this country, such as Chicago, Houston, New York, and L.A. So again, there's a difference between a pleasant city and a powerful city.
Joel, Tyler says let's leave the national out of it, but it's hard to do when not one American city makes the top, 25 or almost 30 in the Economist list anyway, not one.
The other one that sort of made me laugh and always makes me laugh is Pittsburgh. If anyone has ever been to Pittsburgh, which I have, it is really boring. It is an economy that is largely built around universities, nonprofit foundations, a few financial institutions. It's economically been it's actually looked relatively good in the recession because it wasn't anywhere before the recession. And one quick thing, more people die than are born in Pittsburgh every year. So I don't know if that's an endorsement.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about just a couple of new lists of the world's most livable cities, one in Monocle magazine, one in, out from the Economist's intelligence unit, and why so few American cities are on these lists, asking, you know, is there something somehow that American cities are going in the wrong direction? Well, we've got one in the top 25 from Monocle magazine. Honolulu, 1 out of 25. The Economist, 0 until you get down to rank number 29. Then they've got Pittsburgh, Honolulu, and Chicago coming in at 29, 30, 31. What about the top of those lists? Tyler Brulé is editor-in-chief of Monocle magazine. Their list is up at our website, onpointradio.org. Pico Iyer, journalist and travel writer, travels all over the world, author of Global Soul and The Open Road, joins us from Santa Barbara. He sees a lot of cities. Joel Kotkin is here. He's writing a he wrote The City, A Global History. He's writing a kind of a book on the American future we'll ask him about. John in Stonington, Connecticut. John, you're on the air. What do you know?
Just wanted to pass along my comment about Zurich. My wife and I visited Zurich twice, and what I noticed most was a very calm and peaceful feeling about the city. There was a very vibrant feeling of life there, but and plenty to do. But it was more relaxed than any American city I've been in.
A net positive then? Good calm or dull calm?
Oh, good calm. The city had a very alive feeling, but the pace of life just felt different, and I suppose that's just because of a difference maybe between the American personality and the European.
Could be. Thanks, John. Let's go to Joe in Shirley, Massachusetts. Joe, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks
Hi.
For taking my call.
Yeah.
I've been to both Zurich and Copenhagen, and I'm with your folks on Copenhagen. It was a wonderful, charming, lively city. If you don't mind, secondary smoke all over the place,
okay,
including in the public transportation system. Anyway, I visited Zurich when my son lived there. Now, I grew up in New York, but I am now in a rural area, and I consider myself an old woman. When I got to Zurich, I felt like, whoa, this place is dead. Everything's clean and things are running on time. Not too much eye contact. And I had a new, wonderful grandson who nobody Googled. Gaga, you know, that kind of thing.
Nobody said, what a cute baby.
Right, like they do in New York City.
Right, right.
And we went out to eat one night and couldn't finish what we had and asked them to package it up. And we were waiting for it outside and finally went back in, and they said, we thought you were kidding, which seemed like a kind of snide thing.
Too cool for school. Joe, thanks for that report. Pico, let me turn to you first on this. Maybe the issue here is, you know, does livability equal dull, boring? I mean, our caller John says, no, not in Zurich. It's serene and vital. It's good calm. Joe goes and, you know, she's bored. Livability equals boring, Pico, or something else?
Well, I think Tyler began this discussion by saying that they were looking for absence of friction, friction-free places like Zurich. And I think he was right in saying that that's what we want when we live in a place. But when we visit it, we're usually looking for excitement. So I think the visitor's view of Zurich is always going to be different from the resident. The resident is delighted with calm. The visitor is bored by it. And I think one of the other things about Zurich, like Paris, like Kyoto, like some of the other seductive cities in the world, is that it weaves the old and the new together very, very imaginatively. And you have this very textured sense that one minute you're walking down a 16th century street, the next you're looking at something, some kind of high-tech innovation you could never imagine seeing, even in a place like Santa Barbara. And I think that's one advantage the older cultures have that the U.S. will always find difficult to keep up with.
Joel Kotkin, here's a comment from one of our listeners online saying, Americans don't live, we produce. And certainly other cities on the list are economic centers, but, you know, America's material concerns are our MO, our modus operandi. Enjoy life, live it, forget it. He says, I'll do that at Starbucks on my way to the office. What about that, Joel?
Well, I think that that's an interesting point, but I think America, and this is part of what I'm going to be talking about in the new book, I think Americans are also have another part of their characteristic, which de Tocqueville noted in the 1830s. We actually are pretty community-oriented. We obviously belong to churches, synagogues, mosques at a much higher rate than most of these other countries. We have a lot of community associations. I think there is a great sense of localism. What I do think is has been missing in American cities, and I think a point was made by one of the other commentators, is the sort of human scale of neighborhood. And whether it's in a suburb or whether it's in a city like New York, which you may be able to tell is my hometown,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. that I think that we are moving back to trying to create much greater neighborhood sense. One thing that's very interesting, I live in Los Angeles, which is kind of ground zero for the 21st century in some ways. And when I first got here, it was undifferentiated mass from one neighborhood to another. Today, neighborhoods have councils. They have a sense of identity. People are much more likely, and I have a piece coming out soon in Newsweek about this, much more likely to go to a local restaurant. So there are many things that we can learn from some of these other cities around the world without surrendering the dynamism and diversity that makes up a lot of our friction. I think there is a lot that we can learn. And I think Americans are going through a kind of cultural and spiritual sort of rebirth or rethinking about what our society is about, and that in this mad rush of the last 20, 30 years, we have lost some things. And I think you can always learn. One of my fondest clients is in Copenhagen, so I've visited there. And there are things we can certainly learn from the Danes on a lot of issues. So I think that Americans are beginning to question some of this material obsession. And I think there's a lot that we can learn. But I think that it will happen in America like things always happen in America, from the community and the grassroots up.
Tyler, is there a new world, old world issue here? Americans perhaps celebrate dynamism, diversity, maybe even friction. And, from a European perch, that looks like non-livability. Or is it an unfair criticism?
Well, I think we have to go back to both lists, though, because there are certainly some other New World contenders who do very well. And as you cited at the top, Australia, very much New World, does well, as does New Zealand, as does my native Canada. And I think maybe Pico was referencing it, at the top as well, that there is just a sense of the global maybe having to fend for yourself in a different way, or there's a certain type of collectivism within the Commonwealth world that makes it a little bit different. But I think what was really interesting about Joel's comment right now was this notion of the rethink. We were just shadowing your new transport secretary, Mr. Lahoud, mm-hmm. who's been on a tour of Europe. He was here 2 weeks ago, looking at the Spanish high-speed rail model, looking at the German high-speed rail model, and the French one as well. And I think that is part of a rethink. I don't think we would have seen that in past administrations, a high-profile tour of saying maybe some other places have it better. And I think that's, I also think a lot of local press, it happens all over the world, but I'm sure if a mayor in Atlanta or in Jacksonville decided to get on a plane to go and visit five or six of these cities, he'd be beaten up if there still was a local paper by the time he got back. And I think that part of this rethink, does involve doing a bit of benchmarking, which you can't do simply on Google. You have to go and feel the street under your feet.
Pico, when you look at the Economist's criteria, they've got so much of this goes to national policy. I mean, they look at healthcare, environment, education, infrastructure. And pretty soon this looks way beyond a mayor's purview, Pico, and sort of captures cities as indicators of national priorities policy.
Yes, which is why you can't take these cities out of their context. And if you're comparing, say, Switzerland, Denmark, and the U.S., of course, the U.S. is always going to inspire much more contention within itself and around the world than those relatively neutral countries. And the other thing that you were suggesting just now, I think rightly, is that the places that do well often are relatively homogeneous, like Copenhagen, Helsinki, or Tokyo. The U.S. is a hub of immigration, and every time new people are streaming into Los Angeles, in some ways they are making it more chaotic, and they are challenging the existing structure. And I think one reason the U.S. cities do badly in these surveys is because of the sort of mobility and the commotion that goes with them. They're not going to be placid ever as long as people are streaming into them from every other corner of the world.
And yet Americans aren't exactly sailing back to Europe in droves, but we'd like to make it as livable as we can here. Gerald in Norfolk, Virginia. You're on the air, Gerald.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm a city planner, so I'm inherently fascinated with the conversation today. I'll preface my comments with saying I'm not familiar with this list or its metrics, but certainly on its face value, I take it as a critique of my profession, of what planners in America have done well or haven't done well. And certainly we can take from this, and we're aware of what makes cities livable. I believe planners have been successful lately in engaging the American public in the dialogue of what is it that makes your city livable or not. And I think the plans that will be resulting from that dialogue will start to see some changes. And we may, in fact, have more American cities getting on that list in a while.
Gerald,
I do have a question.
Oh, yes, please, yeah.
Real quick question. You talk about livability, and a term that has certainly crept into our profession is sustainability. And I'm curious in your survey about questions of sustainability, environmental sustainability. How important was that in a factor in your survey?
Tyler, let me put that to you. Sustainability, does it factor in?
Yes, it's a factor in since we started. And so for, you know, if you look at a Zurich, for example, 51% of waste is recycled. And, you know, there's been a 40% drop in household waste since they charge for rubbish bags. You know, you can't go and buy a Glad rubbish bag if you want to collect it on the street corner. You have to buy one from either from the canton or from the city. So and we've looked at that across the board. Tokyo's ambitions to plant 1 million trees in the city, worked in its favor. So, yes, to the question, very much so we looked at environment.
Joel, let me put a comment to you here from the web. Here's Nancy, and she says, the federal and state governments, that is U.S., have ignored the needs of cities in the U.S. since the interstate highway system brought the white middle class and the wealthy to the suburbs. She says, much of this is about race and class. What do you say, Joel?
Well, first of all, if anyone's been to the suburbs recently, you'll notice that there are a lot of people who are certainly not white and in many cases not middle class either. But so I'm in many senses, if you go to Manhattan, the bifurcation between rich and poor is much greater than it is in the suburbs. And the ethnic diversity of many of our suburbs is much greater than that of many of our cities, particularly in many of the Midwestern and Southern cities where somebody moves from Hong Kong and they don't want to live in a box. They could have done that back home and they get a house. And I just want to one little story that just gives you a different perspective. One guy I work with came in from Sweden. He came to visit me at my house. I live in a neighborhood that is, middle-class neighborhood, very ethnically diverse, people from all over the world. He came to my house, which is a, 2,300-square-foot, rambling old 1930s ranch house. And he said, only top executives in Sweden live this way. In other words, there are certain things that we somehow forget about. When we look outside and we say, oh, doesn't that look great? But if you go inside the places, if you go to my relatives who live in Montreal, but particularly in Paris, tiny little places, there are things that we get as well as things that we lose by the way we live. And in America, a huge number of people, and I think this is somewhat true in Canada and Australia, live in relatively spacious houses with privacy, with a backyard for the kids to play in. Planners hate this. Maybe travel writers don't like it that much. Maybe people who do surveys don't like it that much. But a lot of people like it. And I think that this is something that is a qualitative difference between life in the United States and life in many of these other places. And people have made a choice. Now, I think we can green the suburbs. I think we can make them more livable. I think they are becoming more urban, taking on more urban characteristics and changing. But that is the choice that most people have made. And I don't think we should just immediately dismiss it and say, oh, God, if we could all live in a box in a quaint city, that's the way we should live.
Pico Iyer, that's a great tee-up for you. Your essay was, the joy of less. Joel says, well, what about the joy of more? More space. My home is my castle. Give it to me big.
Well, I've chosen to live in a box in a quaint city. I'm talking to you now in my mother's house in Santa Barbara, which is a lovely big house, and I've left this house to live in a two-room apartment in near Kyoto, Japan, which is probably the size of a bathroom in California. But every time I walk out of my apartment, I don't feel I have to lock it. I never feel that there's ever going to be theft or threat in the air. The people all greet me, even though I'm the one foreigner in the neighborhood. And actually, somehow, even in my two-room apartment, Kyoto seems much more livable to me than Southern California.
Tyler, you got us off on this with your list. Leave Honolulu out for a second. No other American city on there, and Honolulu is kind of one of a kind. If you look at major American cities, was there any other that came close to making your list? And I should say we've got defenders of Pittsburgh piling onto the phone lines and online as well. But any other major American city that came close, way down there in the depths of your list with Kyoto and Hamburg and Geneva and Lisbon? Anybody? Any city?
Well, I have to say we're not as guilty as our friends at The Economist. Pittsburgh, we didn't even address Pittsburgh. We looked at Chicago. We looked at Portland. We looked at Minneapolis. We looked at Seattle. Portland has been present before, early on, as we said, its murder rate had jumped by 16%. Chicago's was up by 15% as well. So Minneapolis, lucky for them, was down. So again, as a starting point, and Pico makes a very good point. I mean, it is amazing when you look at when you look at Tokyo, which has the population of all of Scandinavia, crammed into one rather remarkable city, that the crime rates are laughably small. And I guess we can't ignore personal safety. But and we tried very hard. I mean, also we've been beat up a little bit in other programs because there are no Latin American cities, there are no African cities either.
Well, maybe that's just the way it is by the criteria you've got, but it's a fascinating thing to look at, and we'll hope for more American cities popping up there as we go. We'll hope, and maybe you have to work for that as well. Tyler Brulé, editor-in-chief at Monocle Magazine, thanks very much for joining us. You're a good sport, Tyler. Thanks for being here this
hour. Thank you very much.
And Pico Iyer, always wonderful to have you. Thanks for joining us from Santa Barbara today, Pico. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Joel Kotkin in Los Angeles. Thanks so much, Joel. Great to have you with us.
Thank you.
We'll look for your book on the American future. Listeners, you can continue the conversation at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.